Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Well, hey, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me today. It's always a pleasure. Here at Exit Coach Radio, we've interviewed over 1,500 advisors of all walks of advisor life, but I've never had someone like my next guest, Kezia Robinson. She's a business strategist, CEO coach, and investor, and she's described by her clients as a shapeshifter. That's the different part, who can coach business owners through any challenge at any stage of their business. Kezia helps small business CEOs navigate the operational and existential challenges of scaling up, pivoting, and or selling a business they've put their blood, sweat, and tears into. Kezia holds a BS in physics from Stanford University. I think that's where the shapeshifter part comes in, and an MBA from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, definitely where the business part comes in. And she serves on the advisory board of Private PACs, an innovator in the fast-growing femtech industry. Kezia, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the show. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your interesting background and diverse background. You went through Stanford with a physics major and an MBA from Wharton. What an interesting background. Tell us a little bit about that and what you do for your clients.
Well, one of the things that's great about physics, I did think at the time I was going to be a physicist, and then I started putting in the work. And as with a lot of things that are dreams when we're little, you start putting in the work and you go, wait a second, this isn't really what I had in mind. But one of the great things about physics is we work a lot from first principles. So really getting down to the brass tacks and not over-engineering things, and which sounds crazy because people think of it like that. But it really is a wonderful background. And I think bringing that into business, it's the same thing. And I like to take that to my clients to really help them strip away. You know, they've read all the books. They've got sometimes they bought all this software. They've had 6 or 7 advisors. And they really just need to get back to the basics and really kind of come down to the first principles of how they want to run their business and how they want to leave their business.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think a lot of people do get caught up kind of in the weeds after several years of running their business, don't they? They get into a situation where, you know, what they originally may have thought they started the business for kind of gets overwhelmed by all the stuff. I hear that all the time from business owners that are really burned out. They're just saying, you know, I just feel like the business is running me now, and there's so much going on. And you have a phrase, helicopter parenting your business, and why you need to stop it as a business owner. What does it mean? What does that phrase mean to helicopter parent your business?
Well, if we think of, you know, if people who have, especially with, you know, boomers, right, often they've got kids who are in their teens, 20s, is helicopter parenting is when, you know, you're still doing your kids' laundry, right? They're in college and you're driving out to pick it up because somehow they couldn't take care of themselves. Or writing your kids' college essays or doing their homework or putting a tracker on their phone to keep track of them when they're really capable of living their own lives. People do the same thing in their business because it comes from a place of love, of course, and same thing in the business. You want to sit on a sales call, let's say, and there's no reason if you're running a business and you've got, you know, a half dozen salespeople, there's really no reason that you need to be involved at any point in the sales process, right? You're a sales strategy. Mm-hmm. But you know, I have a great client who runs a real estate practice, and and when I first started working with him, I mean, he was trying to get on and close every single prospect, and he had a great team, right? But he couldn't let go of that, and he really wanted to still be involved.
Yeah, you know, I think I resemble that remark. I think, you know, that when I think about times when I really tried to expand my business and I hired good people and I just wasn't seeing their results, and I think that probably directly reflects back on me and my processes. And so I didn't fully trust that the people that I had involved, and we see this a lot in family businesses, right? I didn't fully trust, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm delegating this to you, but I'm also watching. I'm watching, and that's the helicopter parent. I like to, you know,
right.
Yeah, you're in college, but I'm still going to check your laundry. Why is it so hard for owners to stop doing this? What do you think it is that doesn't allow a business owner to just say, hey, I trust you completely, go do it?
Well, I think there's often people don't know what's on the other side. So you think about selling a business. You know, everyone's like, oh, I want to sell my business. Well, what are you going to do once you sell the business? So same thing happens even if you're growing the business. Oh, I want to stop doing all these sales calls. Well, what happens, what are you going to do if you're not on all the sales calls? So a lot of times people just haven't thought about what's on the other side. I'm helping people grow out of the world they're in, but you also have to know what you're going to grow into. And that is one of the things that is, because it's got to be something on the other side. Otherwise, it's just like a vacuum, right? And you're a business owner, I'm a business owner. Like, we like to work.
Mm-hmm.
And we like having control over our own destinies, right? That's part of why we run our own businesses. So the idea of having this vacuum on the other side where you have, what are you supposed to be doing all day? And what are you supposed to have control over? That's very, very scary. And so that's pretty much one of the first things I do with people is I got to sit down, I got to talk about goals, and I got to talk about what happens after.
Let's get a good vision on what you're going to be doing with your time, right, after you're not doing this anymore. And I think for a lot of owners, a lot of businesses out there may not be able to, you know, we talk about this a lot, Kezia, that a large percentage, 8 to 9 out of 10, try to go to a business broker and think, I guess I'm going to sell my business like they're going to sell their house, you know, but it ends up not going well. They're either dejected because the price is too low, or they're rejected because the broker says, I'm not going to waste my time on your business because it's all about you. So if you're going to get out of that, how do they get out of that? What can you tell our listeners, some practical tips to break out of this pattern of helicopter parenting their business?
Well, I do think the practical tip is to do some goal setting, right? That's very important, and that's something you may need, you know, professional to help. There's lots of tools and techniques, but I think it is really important to, you know, I tell people to do an ideal day to really look at, like, what do you want your day or your week to look like on the other side of the transaction, so you have that thing to hold in your mind. The second thing you got to figure out is what you're going to give up when you're going to go to the transaction. What are you going to give up? You're going to give up being the most important person, maybe having control, maybe having steady income. Sometimes people, they get scared by the idea of, I'm going to sell this business and I'm going to go from having a salary to having now a lump sum, right? So there's very much the mindset has to be there. If you've got those two things, then it's all just toolkit, right? It's that, from that point, it's really all process. And the first thing I say on that side is you got to take a look at your team. You got to look through and you got to really understand, can the people I have here do the work that I am doing at a minimum, right? And if the answer to that is no, and I would venture a lot of times it's yes. It's just that you need to train them or you need to set them free and just let them do the job. But if the answer to that is no, then you have to have a real conversation about hiring and how you're going to bring in talent that is not complementary to you, but is in fact competitive with you because you're trying to bring in talent that will replace you. So it's kind of get your head straight, and then you got to really take a good look at the business And then you have to go and decide, is this a training issue where I need to, like, there's knowledge transfer? Is this a control issue where I'm just afraid to be here and realize that, you know what, my sales staff, they're all better salespeople than I am, right? Or they're all better architects than I am, depending on what your business is. Like, that is also scary for people, but that's the goal. And then if you don't have that in-house resource, you do have to be realistic about, you know, how am I going to find this externally? Or sometimes people look at you and realize your exit strategy is not really a sale. It's more like you're going to merge your book. Let's say you're a lawyer or something. If the business doesn't exist without you, you might be looking at finding someone to merge your book into and a business, and then negotiating something out of that. So sometimes there are many alternatives, but the first thing you got to do is figure out what you want.
Very good. So some really good goal setting. You know, it's funny because I always tell people that it's about three T's, but listening to you, I think I've just added a fourth T. The three T's are your timing, when you want to be either part-time or fully out of this business. Second is your target. Who do you want to run the business? And third is the treasure. What do you need to get out of this transaction? But the fourth one that I think I just added because of you is team. What do you want? What does your team need to look like? And you know, a big part of that is making sure that your team doesn't run away when you tell them that they have a new owner or a new leader. So you have something called a 3D model, and I don't want to mention it and blow it for you. So what's the 3D modeling, and tell us how our listeners can use that.
Well, the 3D model is the, and I got this from somebody else, so I don't want no trademark on that, but it is the delete, delegate, do. It is the order of action. So to your point earlier, all of my clients are doing too much and not getting enough done. So that is when you start to get into, let's say, the part that often happens, well, I can't possibly stop doing X, right? Or the whole, I'm too busy. A lot of times, I'm too busy to plan for my sale. I mean, I'm sure you see that all the time, and you're like, you know, well, you're not going to have a sale to plan for if you're too busy all the time, right? So one of the things to look there is really going through the tasks and going through what's on your calendar and going, what actually, do these things have to happen at all? Often,
right.
I mean, there's a level of over-engineering. I had somebody once, and he's like, well, I need to send... I was a financial advisor, and he's like, well, I got to make sure the email gets sent like this and that. And I was like, does the client care? Like, does this matter to the client at all? No. So it's like delete, right? Take that one off. And then the delegate is that process of really saying who's on the team and what tasks. Sometimes it's outsourcing. Sometimes there's functions. I had a guy who was looking to sell his business, and he was like, you're going to pry the bookkeeping out of my cold, dead hands. I balance my checkbook. I love it. I love it. I love it. Took about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer in his hands, right? So mm-hmm. there is that mm-hmm. process. And then the do is really, what do you need to do? What is at your pay grade? And this is another thing that can be hard for people mm-hmm. to say. As the business is growing, it's not that you're above the work, right? You could certainly roll up your sleeves and help. But that work, the frontline work, the middle management as the business keeps growing, that is below your pay grade. So what is at your pay grade when you get to higher and higher levels? And that is that more strategic work, that is negotiating with partners, right? If you have that makes sense to your business to have strategic partnerships, that can be preparing, you know, the operations for the sale. There can be a lot mm-hmm. of things, but that's the do. So that's the 3D model. Delete,
yeah, I love
delegate,
that, you know, it's so important that as owners head towards an exit, as they start to say, you know, okay, the next 3 to 5 years, that's a common timeline, I'm sure you hear too, is I want to be out of this thing. Well, are you the CEO, the chief executive officer, or the CEO, the chief everything officer, where everything, mm-hmm. you do everything
exactly.
in this business? Because you have to morph your duties and get rid of, like you say, delete, delegate, get rid of most of your duties, because you're going to have to pick up a whole bunch of new duties on the way to grow your way out of owning a business. And that's, I think that's the key thing I see a lot is a lot of owners, the key thing they need to do is be the chief value builder. They need to start growing the value and the attractiveness and the sustainability of their business on the way to the sale. So you have something called three things every business owner needs to know before selling your business, and maybe we've touched on some of those. But if not, tell us what those three things are.
Well, we definitely touched on them. It's where, what are you doing afterwards, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think we said on the other side of the sale. And then what are you giving up? The last one is who's on your team, and that includes the broker, where, I mean, there's a huge variation in quality, and having a really solid business broker is critical. That can be your financial planner, that can be your legal, as well as all of your internal team. That can be your strategic, the target, like you said, the person who's going to, you're trying to sell it to. You know, who are they, and are you positioned with them that they're going to, it's a team, right? So that they're looking to, yeah, there's money, but this is a collaborative process of getting the sale done, as opposed to an antagonistic, you know, negotiation for getting the sale done. So those are the three things you need to know.
And is that an area where you come in and help an owner? Because what I find is this, is that oftentimes they say, well, I have advisors, but yeah, have they ever worked together as a team? I mean, do they know each other? Do they talk to each other? Do they look at each other's ideas and shake their head, or do they nod their head? And so do you get involved in that way to help owners say, look, we really need to be clear on these goals that we're talking about so that we can communicate that to these other advisors so they all have the same perspective?
Absolutely. And I am always encouraged, and there's always some legal stuff, but I encourage my clients to say, let's get together, right? Let's get on the phone. And make sure that the client is giving the same message to everyone as well. Because sometimes the client is still, you know, especially when I work with them, they're still trying to figure stuff out. So they may have told a lawyer they talked to 3 months ago something. Now that we're doing some work, they're coming. You know, I've had clients where a lot of times there's some unfinished business. They want to grow the business. You could be in your 60s, but there's some dream they want to get going on the business. And so they've been talking to a broker a year ago about selling X, and now we're working to transform the business. And that broker doesn't even know you're trying to sell a new business, right? They don't know that you added a new product line or you went up market, right? And that makes a big difference to what they're working on. So I think it's very important to have the team on the same page and then work with people who are collaborative in nature. So that's often a good screen, too. I've occasionally had people where they're like, oh, well, let's get the financial advisor on. The financial advisor's like, no, we do this internally. We have a this, we have a that, whatever. And I'm like, this is not the financial advisor to help you get through a transaction if they are determined to have you only use their in-house resources.
Yeah, I think one of the ways, men who are out business owners that are thinking about sports analogies is, are they a better golfer than they would be a basketball player? If your advisory team is a basketball team, then they're not going to hog the ball all the way up and down the court. They're going to pass off, right? They're going to have to,
yes.
Right? But if they're golfers, they're working on their own, and they don't really collaborate with others. They're just playing their own game. And so it's really important, like you said, to have that someone you can talk to as a business owner who can pull those goals out of you and get those into a written state, so then that can be shared with all your advisors so they all have the same perspective and be able to change that as they learn new data. I've had a lot of owners who thought they were stuck on one strategy, one exit plan, and then they realized, boy, it's not everything I thought it would be. So great tips. How do our listeners best get in touch with you and learn more about you?
Well, I am, if not the only, one of the only Kezia Robinsons on LinkedIn, so that's always a great place to reach out to me. And I love just hearing about people's businesses. So please, if you have anything that's you just want to kind of tell me about your business, feel free to reach out. And I also, you can reach me through my website, which is www.cassia-partners.com, C-A-S-S-I-A-partners.com. That's the name of my business.
And just for those who might not know, Kezia is spelled K-E-Z-I-A-H, Robinson. Kezia Robinson, very
absolutely
nice to talk with you. It's great to have you on for the first time. I always tell first-time guests, you know, if you'd like to come on down the road and share some more, we just scratched the surface today. So thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And thank you for listening. It's a pleasure to have you with me. And, you know, we interview a wide variety of advisors. As I mentioned earlier, over 1,500 advisors have been on ExaCoach Radio. So if you think about it and you want to listen to 20 minutes of business-oriented information, head to wherever you listen to podcasts and look for ExaCoach Radio. My next guest, Megan Lynch, is a CEO of Six Point Creative, a brand strategy agency that helps second-stage companies break through growth plateaus. As part of her mission to help small business challenge the Goliaths, Megan has served as an expert advisor to second-stage clients in a wide range of industries, from fast casual restaurants to industrial manufacturers. And Megan was named an Enterprising Woman of the Year in 2019 and enjoys testing her limits as an endurance runner. Welcome to the show, Megan. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
My pleasure. Wow, you have an interesting background. I'd love to hear more about that. Tell our listeners a little bit more about you and your business, and we'll get into some of the questions.
Yeah, sure. So I started Six Point, it's around 2007, just as the market was crashing, so made it through
perfect
one
timing.
Great recession, and yeah, perfect timing. And basically when we started, we were very like sort of generic, local, regional, full service marketing agency, and I'll put full service in air quotes, because it was, you know, a few smart people in a room, you know, just kind of getting stuff done. And over the years, as I started to grow that business and kind of get myself more educated about what it means to grow and lead a company, I started joining more peer roundtables and really educating myself, because I don't have a background in business or anything like that. So, and while I was doing that, I just started spending more and more time with a lot of like family-owned businesses, second-generation businesses, closely held businesses that people were starting, you know, and kind of growing and trying to sustain. And I just realized, like, oh, like, these are my people. Like, this, I love working with these kinds of businesses that are devoted to their communities and are really trying to make something sustainable for themselves, their families, their employees. And it was also where I started to realize that the brand strategy work that I was doing for other kinds of companies was like particularly helpful to these companies, that they didn't often really know how to build equity in their brand or how to use brand strategy to create business outcomes.
There's a lot, there's many facets of what you do that intrigues me. But one question I have before we get into it is, what do you, when you say a second stage company, tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, so second stage companies are between 10 and 100 employees. It's usually around then that you start to have this tipping point early on of starting to feel some of these like just pains of like, oh, we used to just grow with no problem and now we're kind of plateauing, or it's not as easy to get customers as it used to be, or we need a lot more processes, or the people problems are getting out of control, all of those kinds of like early stage pains. And then later on in second stage, often the issues are much more about, okay, well, how, you know, now that we have, you know, processes and systems in place and we're really ready to grow, how do we keep alignment? How do we kind of bridge where we came from and who we used to be with what is going to kind of get us to this like next level, and not kind of like lose the DNA of who we are in the like growth and scaling process? So that kind of tends to be like what second stage companies are all about. And it's sort of like both a uniquely painful business life stage, but also
right.
kind of a uniquely exciting and yeah, just transformational one. If you can make it through second stage, you can do anything.
Very good. And, you know, I'll use a golf analogy. I know a lot of people, when they start tracking their handicap, and it's probably in the 20s or something very high. And it's fairly easy with some, you know, regular practice to get that down to about an 18 or a 17. And then you get into the next phase, maybe this is where the second stage comes in, where you have to start changing your game to get better. You have to start changing how you
exactly.
do things to get better, right? And, of course,
exactly.
you know, and then people go crazy
yeah.
after that trying to get better. But
right.
there are
yeah,
a lot of businesses.
One of our
yeah. Go ahead.
So, no, I was just going to say, one of the things that we often remind our clients is, like, what got you here won't get you there, that you can't,
mm-hmm.
yeah, whatever made you a better golfer early on, you have to kind of get into more, like, nuanced finesse work to make that next leap.
And that's where you need, that's where you really need an outsider to help you to maybe, because there are rules of the road and tricks of the trade. So there are things that need to be probably looked at differently and implemented. What are some of the fears that hold high potential companies back from growth?
Yeah, I mean, I think that fear of loss is a very strong human feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like particularly for second stage companies, for family businesses, it is something that really does strongly hold them back from growing and from even building equity in their company because they have a lot to lose, right? Like, they have employees who are counting on them. They have a reputation. They have customers who are counting on them. Oftentimes their identity is very tied up, you know, by this point in the business and kind of what they do in their community. Sometimes they are like pillars of the community. And
mm-hmm.
so the stakes are not low for them. And, but I feel like sometimes they let themselves get so afraid of like, oh, well, if we change anything, we're going to lose what we have. And,
mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, in our experience, you can kind of have both, right? Like, you can keep what you've built and you can also make the changes needed to kind of position yourself for that next leap.
So it's a kind of a case of if it ain't broke, don't fix it, but they don't realize that it is broke, or it's not going to, you know, it's not going to achieve high growth from here on out if they don't make some changes. And, you know, I think one of the areas that might hold back some companies is they've always done it this way. And
yeah.
And I work with a lot of family businesses, and they basically, there's a new generation coming up saying, things have changed. We need to change up how this business looks, how it looks to the world. What are some of the brand strategies that you run into that need to be put in place for family businesses?
Yeah, such a good question. So I think particularly for family businesses, and especially ones that are kind of like working that generational like conflict or transition, a lot of what they're dealing with, I would say, like, of all the family businesses that we work with, I would say most of them, when they come to us, have 70% or more of their customer concentration in one market or even in just a few big customers, big relationships. And it's just super, super common when you've had this like long track record of success. Family businesses are very relationship oriented. And so this idea of like doing anything new becomes also sort of like a threat to the stability of the business, because it's like, oh, well, if we enter this new market, if we do too much digital, we're going to lose these customers who got us to where we are. But at the same time, that level of concentration is so high risk that it's really not a sustainable way for, you know, to to be around for the next 20, 30, 50 years. So a lot of the work that we do is around helping them diversify that customer base and really say, like, okay, well, how do we talk to these existing customers, make sure that we are not going to lose them, create a strong communication plan around whatever is happening, and also look at some of these new opportunities that are on the table and pick the ones that are the strongest, and also craft a strategy that opens up some new business, diversifies the business, strengthens the brand. So I think that brand strategy becomes a lot about that, that diversification piece, especially kind of like as a first problem to tackle.
In the COVID environment and hopefully post-COVID environment, things have changed obviously over the last year or so. And have a lot of people been forced to change their branding to appeal to the online marketplace more and to the worldwide market, if you will, the companies that might have been perceived as too regional in the past, as they change to more of an online footprint, what are some of the things that they're doing to reflect that?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen just obviously like an explosion in e-commerce, and even for brands that historically have not dipped their toe into e-commerce or really haven't paid much attention to it, they really started seeing growth and the business case for like, okay, well, we're getting growth and we're not even doing anything, so maybe we really need to do this. Or they were seeing their competitors grow while they were staying out of that game. So that's definitely something. And I think, for a lot of companies, I think one of the things to realize about digital is that, like, it's really not different. Like, the basics are the same. You create good relationships. You're authentic. You are clear and consistent in your messaging. You know, the same like true basics that make other channels effective are the same here. I think it's where people get tripped up. It's like, they don't know what they need to pay attention to. They don't know which channel is right for them. They don't know where their customers are. They don't know where their prospective customers are. So
right.
Again, they kind
right.
of get like frozen with like, we don't even know where to start. And so often
yes.
the starting point that we use with our clients, and that we, I would counsel anybody to do, because you can do it on your own. You don't need us, is to just start, surveying and interviewing your customers and talking to them and saying, like, what is your, not about like satisfaction surveys, but like, what is your life like? Like, how often are you online? What sites do you go to? What devices do you use? Just kind of understand what their buying behavior is like, in a way that's relevant to your business. But all you need to do is do like 10 or 12 of those interviews, and you already start seeing some patterns, and it starts to demystify, if companies like, oh my gosh, do I have to worry about TikTok? Should I be on Instagram or Facebook, or should I be on LinkedIn, or should I be doing e-commerce? Your customers will tell you that information. We're just often, for whatever reason, reluctant to ask.
Yeah, so many platforms, so little time. One of the things I've heard from companies is that as they start to think about future generation ownership or whatnot or passing the baton, that they'll change from a name-based company to maybe initials mm-hmm. instead of the name, or if they say like we're the Orange County blah blah blah, they'll take out that region so that they're more so that they're not confined in the consumer's mind to only working in a certain region. What are some of the other common mistakes you see that companies make when they're contemplating rebranding?
I think sometimes is like stressing too much about those details. I mean, I think sometimes
mm-hmm.
taking away a place identifier and stuff can be helpful, but I think sometimes we think that we put way too much weight in a name, and we're like, oh, this name has got to like explain the full scope of what we do and capture it. And I often think that's wasted energy. Like, you think of all of the most valuable brand names, they're all like nonsense names, Xerox and Apple and Google. And, it's like the name is what you make it, and your brand is what people say about you when you're not in the room, to quote Jeff Bezos. You know, it is your reputation. And so if you've built equity in a brand name, it always kind of like hurts me a little bit in the gut when people change their name to initials, because it's like, oh, you know, even if it's a person's name, you know, that name has personality, that name has emotional connection, and you just stripped all that away and, you know, became initials.
Right.
You know, where it's like, I would work rather, you know, like, let's change the story. Let's tell the story. Let's not necessarily jump right to a name change or a logo change or whatever. Sometimes it's really about communication strategy, not those kind of like superficial elements that I think sometimes we spend a little too much time on.
Very, very good advice. How about for some of these multi-generational family businesses where they've, you know, it started with the parents. Okay, then then they had their few children get involved. Now those children had a few children, and now, you know, that third generation is now 15 potential people getting involved in the business. And pretty soon you have this big kind of mushrooming number of people that want to be involved in the business, whether they're qualified or not. What about, have you run into situations like that where families have said, look, let's do this. Let's get involved in the community in another way, maybe with a family foundation, and really get involved with some charitable groups or others, and let's give some of those family members a job of working with that. How do you figure out how best to show up in the community as a family business?
I love that question. Yeah, and I think that there's such power, again, oftentimes these family business brands, and once they get to that like third generation stage, they truly are very powerful in their community, and their reputation, their name, just kind of their presence at certain events and things like that it's very kind of like symbolically powerful, and then also, you know, it can be economically powerful for a community. So I always love it when you can kind of like create a much wider brand impact and brand story by getting community family members involved in different ways. So like you said, setting up a foundation, you know, sponsoring events, creating like marquee events in the community. And then oftentimes too, they're often leaders in their own industry as well. So I think to think both locally of like, where can we make impact and where can we kind of build the brand and the story and the loyalty locally. And then also if you work nationally or internationally, where could we also expand the value of the story in our industry? You know, how could we as a family get involved in policy, in, you know, trade organizations, you know, things like that, where it does really, you know, just being able to have a connection back to the family, even if you're not involved in the day-to-day of the business, getting to know the industry, being influencers in the industry, all of that comes back to the family eventually and supports the work of the business and supports the equity that you're building in the brand and therefore in the value of the company, right? Yeah, it's such a good question. I think it's such an overlooked asset that people don't usually think about spreading out their influence in that way. So, yeah, I'm really glad you asked that.
Yeah, it's branding is really interesting, especially as a lot of our listeners head towards they're thinking about exiting their business. Maybe they're thinking about selling it to a much larger business in their industry as just a strategic sale. And so they need to really work with someone to think about, well, how do we start showing up better, differently in our industry, so that we're not begging them to look at us. They're begging us to let them look at us.
Exactly.
And so it's really important.
What
you do is really, really important. And how do our listeners learn more about you and get in touch?
Sure. So our website is 6.com. Creative. So that's SIXPOINT, creative.com. And we set up a landing page for your listeners. So if you just do /exit coach, there is a free brand assessment on there. So if people want to take that quiz, you get a customized report based on the answers to kind of see, like, where is your brand? You know, if you're thinking about exiting, how much work is there to do and where should you kind of start and focus first? So that's a helpful tool. And there's a couple of other resources as well about building brand value in your company right on that site.
Great information. We went through a lot of information pretty quickly, and I hope you'll come back and share more with us down the road, because I think, again, we just kind of started to scratch the surface, but you really gave our listeners a lot of great tips today, Megan. I really appreciate it, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Bill. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for listening. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to one of many shows on ExitCoachRadio.com. We're interviewing advisors, authors, and thought leaders for their best tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. If you'd like to be a guest on any of our shows, go to guest.exitcoachradio.com. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
You're listening to ExitCoachRadio.com, the information station for age 50-plus business owners, where we're interviewing top advisors for their best tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new one-minute tips every day. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Well, thanks again for being with us. I appreciate you joining me today. It's always a pleasure when guests come back on so we can continue our conversation. And my next guest is Chris Larson. He's been on with us before. He's a founder and managing partner of Next Level Income. And Chris has been investing in and managing real estate for over 20 years. Get this, while he was a college student, he bought his first rental property at age 21. And from there, Chris expanded into development, private lending, buying distressed debt, as well as commercial offices, and ultimately syndicating multifamily properties. And he began syndicating deals in 2016 and has been actively involved in over $225 million of real estate acquisitions. So Chris is really passionate about helping investors become financially independent. We asked him to come back and share some more tips and ideas and strategies with us. Welcome back, Chris.
Bill, thanks for having me back on. Always great to talk to you.
Yeah, my pleasure. I think it was very interesting where we talked about a lot of concepts last time about how you believe multifamily real estate is the holy grail of real estate investing, and using a concept called infinite banking, and what metrics are most important when evaluating investments. So I think it'd be very interesting for our listeners to, if we go a little deeper on those topics. But first, if you would, just share us a little bit of a recap on your background and what you do with people that work with you.
Yeah, no, thanks for the opportunity, Bill. And if you're listening today and you want to learn a little bit more, and I don't cover it in depth, you can get a free copy of my book. We'll talk about that here at the end. But yeah, I've been investing since I was actually younger than 21, but that's when I bought my first piece of real estate. And it was a little single family townhouse in Blacksburg, Virginia when I was in college. And I will tell you that real estate is a get rich slow game. I put less than $3,000 down, and that investment has turned into several hundred thousands of dollars in equity and several thousands of dollars in cash flow a month. And so that's just what the power of compounding and a good plan can do. You know, after starting that and managing my own portfolio of single family rentals for over a decade, really about 15 years, I ended up specializing, transitioning into commercial real estate, which is what you mentioned, Bill, multifamily specifically. And we also do some other things like self-storage, commercial office, and a couple other different areas. But as I talk about in my book and I talked about kind of in the first segment when I was on, I'm a demographics guy. I spent 18 years in the medical device industry. I went into that industry because of the strong demographics that the baby boomers had for needing surgery. And what I saw going into multifamily almost 10 years ago was the millennials were renting. They needed places to live. And what's interesting as we enter this decade is that the age group that has eclipsed the millennials in terms of renter growth is actually baby boomers. So I think if you learn anything today from our conversation, it's follow the demographics and put a good long-term plan in place.
Excellent. You know, a lot of our listeners, of course, Chris, are business owners. And I just was talking to a fairly young business owner the other day, and he said, I've accumulated some money, and I'm going to buy some property. And I said, well, what's your thought? And he said, well, I was thinking about buying an office building for my business because I got to pay rent to somebody. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of owners who tell me that that are older owners that have said, one of the best things I ever did was bought the building that my business is in because, heck, it's worth as much or more than my business is now at this point. However, this gentleman was saying, you know, I talked to someone else and they said, you know, you're probably better off going into residential. And I wasn't sure what your take would be on that, and if that's been colored by the COVID situation, where a lot of people are wondering whether workers are going to be using commercial office space as much. What's your take on the office building? If someone just had, you know, saved up some money to invest in real estate and they own a business, should they buy their building or should they look at a multifamily type of a real estate project?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. There's a lot in there, actually. So we talked previously about using high cash value life insurance or this infinite banking concept that you mentioned to fund these deals. And utilizing that concept, you end up using your own life insurance policy as collateral when you pull money out of those policies. So it's kind of the same thing. What better collateral for a life insurance company than the policy that they own that's on you, right? So it's kind
right.
of similar. I did this. My wife and I both have our own businesses, and we bought a property in downtown Asheville, which I can almost see here from my office window at my house. And we did it because we were looking for a place to rent. So I think it's a fantastic idea because as your business owner said, hey, I got to rent from somebody. What better business owner to collect rent from than yourself? It also, if you talk to a proper tax strategist, they're going to tell you you have a lot of options when it comes to owning your building because now you have two different entities that you can move both revenue and expenses through. So it's going to give you potentially some more optimized tax solution. And then the simple answer to your question is do both. I think that if you're a business owner and you own your own property, and we have a lot of investors that do this, they have properties that they own that they have income coming in from, typically from themselves, sometimes from others as well. And then they also invest in passive real estate deals. And when you do that, and I can't really get too deep into it in the short segment today, but it's certainly something if you want to reach out to me, we can kind of go through. I can put you in touch with some resources. You can end up achieving a higher blended return between the two. They actually complement each other. So an active piece of real estate that you own and a passive deal, if properly structured, that you invest in, combined together can actually have higher total returns, which surprises a lot of people. And again, I'm not an accountant. I'm certainly not your accountant if you're listening. So you'd have to verify all of this information. But I think it's a fantastic area to explore.
Excellent. So under the guise of you know, like you said, tax planning, we encourage you to talk to your tax planners and pencil all this stuff out. But the concept of business office real estate, let's talk about that for a second. Where do you think that's what should you stay away from these days in that marketplace?
Yeah, so I gotta gaze into my crystal ball here. So I'll start off by saying I own commercial office property. I do not think that offices are going away. I think contrary. I think people crave the experience of being together again, you know, to collaborating and doing this. But I do think it's going to change. I think people are going to work from home more. I just mentioned that I'm sitting here in my or standing in my home office instead of my office downtown. So there's a good example of it. But that being said, I think it's all regional. So if you're interested in buying a piece of commercial property, especially an office property, you need to consider where it is. And you have to look again at the demographics. People are moving from high cost, high tax, low business friendly areas like the Northeast to places like the Southeast. They're also moving to the Midwest and lower cost areas. And businesses are moving to, you know, suburbs in a lot of cases, or Florida is a big beneficiary of a lot of this. So I think it's, you have to be very careful when you look at commercial office today. You have to make sure that you're not putting a blanket statement on it and saying it's all good or it's all bad. And you have to make sure that if you're looking in an area that it's growing a lot quicker than the national averages and has good long-term trends when it comes to that.
Okay, let's switch gears to multifamily because, as you mentioned, there are a lot of trends going on with people moving to different areas right now, driving up some prices in some areas. But if I'm in California, and let's say, boy, I really would love to get involved in a project in the Southeast, or in maybe even Austin, Texas, or somewhere like that, maybe somewhere that's not quite up to its prime, like maybe Austin is yet. How do I start getting involved in those areas from where I sit? What's the process to get involved? I don't, you know, California real estate's very expensive right now, but I'd love to diversify and get into some other areas. How did you do that?
Yeah, so there's three areas, Bill, that I tell investors they should look out for when they're evaluating a deal. Number one, that you mentioned, is geography. So the first thing you want to do is decide where you want to invest. And we like to invest in areas that are big cities that are growing faster than the national average. So the Southeast is chock full of these. Cities like Charlotte, Raleigh, Greenville, South Carolina, Orlando, Florida, which is a surprise to a lot of people because it got hit pretty hard last year, but we're actually acquiring a property there right now. We're going to be closing just in a couple weeks on that property. Orlando is one of the top five markets in the country right now for multifamily because companies, hedge funds even from New York, are moving to Florida, and it's really got some outsized growth. Phoenix, Dallas, Houston, Texas, those markets are all really, really nice markets as well. So once you've decided on a geography that makes sense for you, maybe you start talking to some operators that work in that space. This is a challenge for some people, but you want to talk to operators like ourselves, learn about what projects they have they invested in those areas before, and then ask them those questions. Hey, Chris, why are you buying this property in Orlando? What is it that you like about the Orlando market? And then after you're comfortable with the geography and the operator, then start looking at the deal. I know investors, they flip right to the returns, and they say, hey, what is this property going to produce? Well, if you have a bad management team, or you're in a geography where it's, instead of thriving, it's dying, like a lot of the old cities up in the Northeast, or you know, some of these higher tax states like California, where you're having a lot of exodus of people leaving, you're going to be swimming upstream when it comes to that. So again, pick your geography, find an operator that operates in that geography that you're comfortable with, that can answer your questions and educate you, and then at that point, you can start looking at these deals. And that's exactly what we specialize in, Bill, is working with investors that maybe they don't have the time or they're not in that geography, but they want to own and be a part of an investment there.
Excellent. Now, what impact do you think we're sitting here doing this interview in April on tax day, or what was tax day, April 15th, 2021? Tax law changes are being talked about daily. What impact do you think that will have on the migration of people from, say, high tax states like New York or California to zero state tax kind of states?
Yeah, I think we've seen this happening over the past decade, and it's only going to continue. I think the pandemic has accelerated the trend because you don't have, and we've kind of touched on this in previous parts of this conversation, if you're not tied down to an office, then you can live in an area that has a higher quality of life and a lower cost of living. and you're just going to continue to see that accelerate, I think, faster and faster.
Yeah, what's interesting is I was just reading about Truckee, California, which is up by Lake Tahoe area out here, and
yeah.
They're saying that a lot of the local residents are now starting to move out of Truckee because so many people migrated there after COVID that they've ruined their quality
yeah.
of life. So things happened. Migration, you know, migration patterns
yep.
create migration patterns, I guess, on top of there. So,
Absolutely.
You talked about the infinite banking concept and establishing a high cash value life insurance policy. Do you recommend that people do that early in life? Obviously you did. And to what extent, how do you go about designing something like that?
Yeah, so I was a licensed life insurance agent back in my early 20s, so I've had some experience with this over the past couple decades. And really, the younger you are, the healthier you are, the lower the cost of the insurance. So it's always more beneficial, and it's kind of like investing in general. The earlier you start, the better, the more it compounds. It's the same within one of these life insurance policies. And a lot of people may be surprised to learn that these policies gain equity just like a piece of property that you have a mortgage on, which is pretty cool. We actually have a resource on our page. So if you go to nextlevelincome.com, you can get a couple things here to help you out in your process. You can check out our banking page. We have some videos and a white paper that talks specifically about this. You need to work with a specific advisor who knows how to structure these policies. And what I mean by that is if you go out and you buy a typical life insurance policy, the agent is going to ask you how much insurance you want, and they're going to build your policy around that. What the group that I work with does is we build the policies around how much cash value you want. So the benefit of that is you end up building cash value faster, and the cost of the insurance is lower. So if this is a strategy, if this is something that is a good fit for you, I would recommend talking to a group that's experienced in structuring these policies, to help benefit investors or business owners, versus like your traditional typical insurance agent that might be down on the corner.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. There are life insurance it's not just one type of product. It's multiple types of products with multiple types of funding strategies, and it's very important to work with someone who's looking out, you know, to achieve your objectives, not their objectives, on a policy. So when you're working and helping people looking for the next projects, what are some of the most important metrics that you employ? We talked about this a little bit in our last interview, but I think it would help our listeners to hear that one more time. What metrics are most important when evaluating investments?
Yeah, so let's talk specifically about a piece of commercial real estate. So if you're a business owner, which I know you have a lot of listeners, or most of your listeners are, Bill, the great thing about multifamily, for instance, is that it's valued on net operating income, which is much like a business, right? So you have this net operating income figure. So when we're buying a property, the first thing, we go from a high level. Again, we want to be in a geography that's a fast-growing market that's growing faster than the rest of the country. So let's say we identify a market like Orlando, Florida, that we like to be in. We then want to target areas that are high income. So if we have a property that we're looking at, we want to say, okay, if these rents are going to be, say, $1,500 a month, we want to make sure that the average income in that area is about three times that per month. So that'd be about $4,500 a month, you know, call it $50,000 to $60,000 a year at a minimum. And the reason is, you know, if you have renters in the area that are earning $40,000, they probably can't afford a $1,500 a month payment. But if you have renters that are earning, say, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000, like in the area that we're buying the property in Orlando, then $1,500 is very reasonable and actually pretty affordable when you consider that. So from a geographic perspective, you want to identify the large geography that's growing in a very fast way, lots of employers. You want to have high income locally. Then at that point, as you drill down into the property, what we like to look for is inefficiencies in management. So if you're looking at net operating income, you want to look for ways to drop the expenses. So if we can be better operators, we can lower the expenses. And then we also want to look for creative ways that we can actually raise the income. So one of the things that we've been doing is we've been implementing internet and becoming the internet service provider. So we're looking for ways to not only increase the income by improving the property and increasing rents organically, but also look for creative ways. That might also include installing washer dryers. So we're looking for ways to increase both the top line as well as decrease the bottom line. That's going to allow us to increase the delta, drive the NOI higher, which is going to allow us to predictably increase the value of the property over time, which means our investors get higher cash flow and ultimately a higher return.
Excellent tips, ideas, and precautions for our listeners. Again, once again, Chris, you came through shining with great examples. I really appreciate it. The website is nextlevelincome.com. Get in touch with Chris and find out, you know, what he's up to, how they might be able to help you understand more about this. I really appreciate you coming on and taking the time to have one additional interview with me, and look forward to the next time we get to talk, Chris.
Likewise, Bill. It's always my pleasure. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
And thank you for listening. It's been a pleasure to have you with me today. Look forward to the next time we speak on Exit Coach Radio.
Hey, everybody. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit.